Many thanks, Linda. I was really worried that this year might be the first year in my life that I will not celebrate my birthday, but look at this. I'm celebrating my birthday in the presence of all these wonderful people in a place that I have come to know several years ago, Greenbelt, where I participated perhaps 2003 in one of the annual meetings. And it is such a pleasure, really, to be back here. The first time I came, I've learned something that perhaps many of us, whether Palestinians or people who are looking for some sort of solutions to many of the ills of today's world, I have found many solutions here. I have found that people come really to connect with each other. People connect at different levels. People really are keen to know more about the sufferings of people beyond their own immediate communities. That was such a relief. That was such an empowering feeling. And I've learned today through Linda and friends that yesterday in the main convention, in the Sunday prayer, Palestine was the main theme. I've learned that through all of you, Palestine is very alive here in the middle of the most beautiful countryside. My wife is Swedish, and she could not even complain about the weather because this is exactly the weather she has there in Sweden. But she enjoyed the ride here, despite the fact that it took us more than 4 hours instead of two. It's really difficult to get to Cheltenham. Yeah, that crossroad is confusing. As Linda said, I am in the States right now, and I just want to start by telling you a very short story. I was in the very south of the States, Mississippi, in the capital, Jackson, and I took a taxi. And, you know, in the way, the taxi driver noticed my accent. So he asked, "Where are you from, son?" I said, "I'm from Palestine." He said, "Oh, Pakistan. I know Pakistan. It's next by India. I know all the places." I said, No. It's not Pakistan. It's Palestine." He said, "Of course, Pakistan. You have all the problems." I said, "Sir, it's Palestine with an L." He said, "Son," and he looked in the mirror rather irritated. And he said, "Son," he was in his 60s. "Son, no matter what you call it back there, in this country we call it Pakistan." Regardless, Palestine, of course, I then told him Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and he knew it immediately. To him and to many people around the world, Palestine is Palestine. It's a land heavy and pregnant of history, of events. I was born in Gaza, to the very south of Palestine, in Rafah refugee camp. And I've lived in Gaza, in fact, most of my life. And today, the subject is about Gaza. Before 1948, Gaza was a regional hub. And why I'm mentioning 1948, because that is the date, or that is the time when Israel was established. It was a regional hub in terms of trade, in terms of agriculture, a crossroad between Egypt, south and north. Gaza, in the 40s, had a train track that connected it all the way to Cairo and up north to Beirut. Gaza, in the 40s, had cinemas and theaters. It had a very thriving society and economy. In May 1948, and of course a few months before that, with the war that was waged against mostly civilian, unarmed peasants, my grandfather, my grandmother, and my father among them, Gaza had to put up with absorbing almost half the equivalent of half of its population as refugees, as all these people fled under fire from all the surrounding areas and up north looking for refuge. Gaza was there to host them. Gaza was there to open its arms for their brothers and sisters, among them my own family. And there is a very nice story why I was born in Rafah. Rafah actually is the very last point of Palestine. It's the border. Maybe some of you hear about the Rafah crossing. My grandfather with my father, as they were trying to find safe haven, if you may, every 2-3 miles, my grandfather would ask, are we still in Palestine? His comrades, his colleagues would tell him, yes, we are still in Palestine. 2-4 miles later, are we still in Palestine? Yes. Until a point when he asked that very question and they told him, yes, we are in Palestine, but if you take one more step, you will be in Egypt. And there I was born, on the very edge of Egypt. And it could absorb what is now 60% of its population, the refugees. It stood on its feet again, reliant on a very solid society, on a vibrant economy that was based on agriculture. Citrus was very famous in Gaza. And it went on up until 1967, when Gaza was occupied by Israel. And of course, East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And from therein, there has been a journey of rather unprecedented decline, ruthless decline. Today, we do not know the exact situation in Gaza. Nobody knows, especially after the last war in December 2008 and January 2009, this latest attack. We don't know. We don't know because we don't have access. People are so busy surviving. But we know, for example, that Gaza, which is, by the way, a very tiny strip of land, 360 square kilometers, which is at the width at the longest point is 12 kilometers, which is around 9 miles, 8-something miles. That's how it is tiny and small. It has 1.5 million people. 50%, to be very accurate, 49% of the 1.5 million are less than 14 years old. According to UNRWA, which is the United Nations Refugees and Work Agency, they directly feed 1 million now after the war. And according to the World Food Program, they feed 365,000. That means that more than 92% of Gaza families depend directly on handouts. How did we get to this point? How did we get to this point? Especially that after 1993, there was a peace process, and Gaza was considered to be first, that international attention, regional attention should be exerted to rebuild, rebring Gaza. More than $3.6 billion were paid to renew and to rebuild the infrastructure. Gaza economy grew at a double-digit rate between 1997 and 2000. How did we arrive to a point where Gaza now, not only an open-air prison, but a prison where you are not allowed not only to leave, but you don't know if your sentence will actually run out or has a limit? And let me very quickly try to go with you, because I know some of you may have been following some of the news, and give you my own personal understanding of the situation, and then perhaps touch upon how do we go from here. And it's very important, because what happened in Gaza is happening elsewhere. All these man-made disasters could be averted. And nothing should be convincing any of us that humans are born to be violent or born to be extreme. Every single society is the production is the outcome of its own circumstances and of the surrounding environment. The very important date for Gaza was 2005. Why 2005? Because in 2005, Israel unilaterally decided to evacuate its settlers and army from the middle of Gaza, what was named and dubbed then the Gaza Unilateral Withdrawal Plan. And by then, everybody was rather optimistic, because this means that relatively it's the end of occupation, at least partially, part of Palestine. But we've learned that ever since then, it was not really ending occupation. It was rather leaving the midst of Gaza, because Gaza was costly, because keeping 8,000 settlers among 1.5 million people is not an easy business. You needed 8 soldiers per settler. And because the main goal, the main attention is on the West Bank vis-a-vis land. Not to go in details in terms of history, but since 2005, Gaza has been literally put under siege. So Israel has left the middle of Gaza. It created buffer zones around it, and nobody is allowed in and out, except through an agreement with the Palestinian Authority that people could leave through Rafah, which was fine. Up until 2006, a year later, and this was the most significant date in Palestinian recent history, because by then, Yasser Arafat had died 2 years earlier. There had to be elections, legislative and presidential. Mahmoud Abbas, who is now the Palestinian president, won the presidential elections. And in 2006, January, Hamas won the legislative elections, which means that they had the right to form government, or the government. And all the problems, the serious problems that has led us to where we are right now, has started then. Because to me, not as a Palestinian, to me as somebody who studies political science, if a group like Hamas, who are relatively militant, if they opt for political means, meaning if they decide to join the political process, if they decide to run elections, if they decide to be part and parcel of the Palestinian Authority, then that has got to be good news. Because if you accept to be a political player, then this has a cost. You better behave in a certain way. There are rules. And in conflict resolution as a field in general, when such a group decides to run elections, it's hailed everywhere. Like IRA and Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, when they decided to be part of the political process, the whole thing started to be resolved bit by bit. Because then they have to play by the rules. Then there are things to lose and there are things to gain. And in my humble opinion, it was a stroke of genius in the part of the collective Palestinian society to bring in every single political faction under the reign of one legitimate representation. I was absolutely thrilled when I heard that Hamas is running the elections. And it didn't matter to me that Hamas actually won the elections, because 4 years later, the Palestinian people will decide who should be in government. What matters to me is that the Palestinians, despite occupation, despite all the situation that I started by describing, were able to conduct one of the freest elections in the entire region. Despite the oppression and the occupation and the lack of the ability to move freely anywhere, were able to export such an example of tolerance, unity, of acceptance. And guess what? After the elections, something even better happened. all the Palestinian factions went to Saudi Arabia for talks. And in Mecca, they agreed to form a national unity government. The government that was formed represented 96% of the Palestinian polity, because it had the big parties, Fatah, Hamas, and the smaller parties. Again, being detached from politics, for anybody who seeks peace, reconciliation, long-term agreements, sustainable resolution, such a solid, wide-based government has got to be good news, right? You do not want to make peace with half of the society, nor even with 60% of the society. You want to make peace with 100% of the society. And if you've got 96%, that is such good news. That was a historical moment through which I believe the Palestinians were able to hold themselves together to face all the problems and to engage with Israel, with the region, and with the international community on better grounds. But that experience was aborted. It was aborted. And here, we need to understand what happened and who bears responsibility. Because by understanding the situation, then we come to the second part of the talk, which is the role of the international community. While we were preached to conduct democracy, we were told that occupation can only end if you elect your leaders, that Israel will leave your land and you will gain your freedom if you build transparent, accountable institutions, that elections are not optional, they have to happen on time. But when we did that, the results were not very pleasing to some major international players. Then they reneged on the whole agreement. As a result, the Palestinian National Unity Government was actually boycotted by the international community. That, of course, steered by Israel, guided by Israel. That, to me, as a Palestinian, as a scholar who studies political science, was a grave, grave mistake. I would refer most of the current situation to that very grave mistake. Because then the whole process, not the peace process, but the Palestinian political process, was jammed. A group was unable to, at least was not able to gain some sort of legitimacy vis-a-vis the international community. Another group, the world is saying, we can only deal with this man or with that group or with this faction. And this is a recipe for division. Because when you pick and choose who you are going to deal with, then you are certainly going to empower some, disempower some. And it's what exactly happened. Precisely. And to add to all that, some sort of unwritten understanding that to have the Gaza people de-elect Hamas, if you may, maybe it's better to keep them under this inhumane, unprecedented blockade. Well, number one, Hamas did not win in Gaza only. And I happen to be a very secular nationalist person who, for my own belief, Maybe I'm in the wrong place to say secular, but for my own belief, my society is better off because it's a very diverse society. My society is better off with a system whereby it is your citizenship, it is your belonging to the community that matters, not your creed, your color, your religion. But this is democracy. If our people decided that Hamas is to be given the most seats in the parliament, this is their decision. I have to learn my lessons. And the lessons I need to learn are plenty. Number one, the national movement, that is the secular, what the West now are calling the moderates, have been giving the Gazans and the West Bankers and the Jerusalemite and every Palestinian inside and out empty promises. An empty promise after another, myself included. We got into a peace process. Supposedly 5 years later, we had to deliver a Palestinian state. Guess what did we deliver? We delivered more than double Israeli settlements in the West Bank during the Oslo peace process, which was between 1993 up until 2000. We delivered more roadblocks, closures, siege. We delivered humiliations. We delivered inability to move anywhere. That's what we delivered. It's not intentionally. But at least, even if we are aware that Israel is not up to delivering the goods that were promised according to the peace process, we should have been more open. Now we are where we are. That's the bottom line. And we need to find an exit for this. And you know, I'd really like to leave as much time as possible for discussion, because I know some of you may have some questions, and discussions always bring some sort of a warmer conversation. I blame Palestinians for falling into the trap of disunity. I blame ourselves. But believe you me, if any society has been put under the pressure that any Palestinian area is put under for the last 60 years, 60, if any society is put for 1 week, I think cracks will start showing. You are talking about a situation where a father will not know if he or she, or if he will be able to send his son or his daughter to school tomorrow. A situation whereby normality is almost absent. But who did all this? And why all this is taking place? Why aren't we able to change course? Because I believe that Israel has not gone through a journey that we Palestinians have gone through. This self-searching journey has took us so many years, from 1948, where we almost disappeared as a polity, as a political actor, up until 1970s. And beyond, actually. This very long journey has made us to decide collectively that the way forward is to share the land. And by 1988, the 15th of November, and I see some Palestinians, Rima, here, and who remember that date, 1988, I even remember it, and I was young, very young at the time, and I remember the elders of the refugee camp I was born in and lived in gathered all of us to the only TV set in the small neighborhood to watch Yasser Arafat announcing the Palestinian state in 1988, 21 years ago. Now, he announced a Palestinian state on the West Bank, Jerusalem East, and Gaza. That is 22% of Palestine. And he offered that plan as an initiative to the Palestine National Council. That is the highest representative council. And the council approved the plan. Consensus, unanimous. And the plan, as a legitimate plan from Palestinians, was offered to the Israelis. Now, this whole process did not happen in Israel. And as such, We have been dealing with rather personalities, from a prime minister to another. And the crux of it, there is no such a decision in Israel to actually share anything. And the plan, as we learned it, despite the fact for many Palestinians, giving up 78% of what was truly theirs was such a generous compromise. Israel is yet to find its final destination. Israel is yet to decide on the end game. There is absolutely no end game in sight as far as the Israeli society is concerned. The only end game is how much more settlements we can build, how many bypass roads we can do, how many walls we can surround Palestinians. Leave all the rest. What we talk about in terms of politics is important, but on the ground, all these bulldozers are changing the landscape. Today, Jerusalem is almost unknown to any Palestinian in terms of the transformation of the Palestinian city of East Jerusalem. Fine. Israel has got no plan. Israel has got the power and the might. And Palestinians are in a situation where they are divided. And the international community is yet to show some sort of political will, some sort of at least willingness to intervene neutrally in this conflict. I am an optimist by nature. And I have, because I'm in Greenbelt, I want to say that I have been also very, very touched by some indicators from the people of faith. Only last week, the head of the World Church Council issued a statement that was rather interesting, very important at this stage. And he said that Israeli occupation of Palestinian land is a sin against God. And there are many examples. The Anglican Church Synod 4 years ago issuing a divestment call against Israeli companies that collaborate with occupation. And even in America, I have been invited to many faith-based groups and institutions. What I'm trying to say here is that while at the official, formal government level, things are not extremely promising, at the popular public level, things are indeed promising. I see many faces that I know who have been pillars of the campaigns. Andrew here, I see him. I know that he lived in Bethlehem and he wrote a book. And I see many faces. I'm sorry if I forget some. But as far as Palestinians are concerned, they've got a very righteous cause. Their rights are enshrined not only in international law, in UN resolutions, but it's enshrined in the very basis of humanity, of their values, and on the basis of religion as well. No one of us is concerned about the very long-term future. Almost with certainty, Palestinians are there to stay. The issue is what will happen from now till we get to that point. And your help is really needed. It's needed. Number one, this nonsense that people, as people, could be used as hostages has to end. Israel claims that Hamas is taking Palestinians in Gaza as hostage. Fine. For the sake of the argument, let's assume that Hamas is doing that. If you are a policeman and you have a hostage situation, you go in and shoot the hostage, as Israel has been doing in Gaza. More than 1,400 people were killed early this year. You don't shoot the hostage. The number one priority right now is giving Gaza access. The people of Gaza desperately are in search for access to their own livelihood, access to their second half of their country, the West Bank, access to the region. And this could be done through groups like you, really. I have been following many, many groups who have been connecting with Gaza, with Bethlehem, many cities in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Please do this. Do this with some focus on Gaza because it's the topic of today. Politics is going to stay there for a while in that region. And until Israel decides what is it that it wants for itself and for its citizens and for the future, we're going to be in for a long journey. But in the meantime, the human being, their well-being, their dignity has to be upheld and upheld. And this is not happening. And I think all of us has to really shout and say that no matter what the political situation is, every human being has the right to work, has the right to send his or her kids to schools, has the right to travel, has the right to vote. And what is happening in Gaza for the last 2 years in terms of total blockade is a war against humanity. It must end immediately. And I hope and I invite as many of you who can go and visit, you will find the most warm, hospitable community on the face of earth. Go and visit, connect. Forget about all what you hear in the news. They are very simple people who would look up to people who are coming there for solidarity. And do all you can, even if you can't go there, to try and connect with Palestinian local organizations and communities. And Linda and Amos Trust and the many people around here, there are so many organizations rediscovering Palestine who could be your conduit to do that. And sorry if I have extended this talk, but thank you for listening to me, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
People have got any questions, I can give you the mic to.
Thank you very much. You've described the significance and the importance of the fact that Hamas made the switch and recognized the electoral process. It seems to me that we're in a paradox situation where as the power of that gesture, adopting electoral democracy in that situation, is powerful and relevant, here, in particularly in the sort of Anglo-American sphere, electoral democracy seems to be becoming less relevant. There's a feeling of distaste. I wonder if it's time for a sort of a truth movement. You described some of your closing remarks were about the recognition of the essential human truths, of the right to work and education. And it seems that we're in the middle of a paradigm shift at the moment in the Anglo-American sphere, that our situation here is not revealed, but it seems ever more closely to resemble Mussolini's model of fascism, with the complete amalgamation of corporate and state power. And this is maintained through division of loyalty and sensibility, and the left and right division. Yesterday we had a speaker calling for a mobilization of the left. The left is run out. The left has no ideas. The left has no passion. It has no power base. But people have a sense of injustice and fraud. Could you respond with your reflection to that question? Is the, you know, the political process just completely...
Well, Palestine is part of a world, and the world has its own system. And Palestine is part of a region, and the region has its own issues. And because of the particular situation in Palestine, Palestine is very exposed to the interference and intervention of external powers, systems, ideologies, name it. And big part, as I described in my talk, big part of our problem has been this external intervention, interference, more than intervention. Because Israel would not have been born as it was and the way it was on the skulls of hundreds of thousands of people in the most ruthless, illegal manner in 1948 without the Balfour Declaration that was issued in this very country. And by the way, despite the fact that I was a diplomat in this country, I used to be very undiplomatic and say that Britain has to be in the forefront of searching for a solution for a problem they created. I wish I had that applause in the Foreign Office when I said it. And from there, go on. This is not to say only Britain, but, you know, Britain has a successor, the United States. And without the U.S., Israel will not be where it is right now. It will not be as reckless, as irresponsible. By the way, it is irresponsibility even vis-a-vis their own future. This is, to me, as if you are shooting yourself in the foot. And Israel has been shooting itself in the foot hundreds of times, but it has the U.S. backing it, and therefore, each time there is a foot shot, the U.S. will give them a new one. Literally, a veto in the U.N. system, a huge aid, $3 billion per year, has been heavily subsidized. And not everything is blamed on the West. No. Look at the Arab world and how much it has intervened and interfered in our affairs and what ill they have inflicted upon us throughout the years. Because it was their interest, their survival, that is the regimes, the Arab people are absolutely clear on what they believe in terms of the justice for their brothers, the Palestinians, but the regimes. Look at the situation now and Iran. Iran, I don't think Iran is really one of its principles is the liberation of Palestine. But Iran is playing politics. And we are, and America is playing politics. And there is a proxy war in the region. There is a showdown. And we are paying a heavy price. We are picking the bill. And we have been made to pick the bill long ago. The Holocaust was the most horrific human act in modern history. But we Palestinians, up until today, made to bear much of the responsibility of something that happened in a different continent, that has to do with different religions and different history, in a third party. And we Palestinians, after 60 years, are made to bear the responsibility and the cost of a war between two different countries, Iran, America. And believe you me, much of this is a showdown on any open playground. And Palestine right now is an open playground. The bottom line, my friend, is without a change in the international behavior and actors, we will be in for a long, long, long ride. I am optimistic about Obama, by the way, I have to admit. And fearing that my optimism might be false, fearing that I might give, but I've been living in the U.S. I do feel, I have a sense that he is very well aware of much of this discussion. Not because he likes Palestinians or Brits for that matter, but because he believes that the strategic interest of America requires a change of course. For the strategic interest of America, there has to be a new map in the region. There has to be a different course of action vis-a-vis their own foreign policy. I'm hopeful, but how long his breath is with comparison to the Israelis, I don't know. But what I know is Bush Senior had a very similar understanding, had a very similar idea. Bush Senior, in the year 1991, when he was a president, he forced the Israelis into the negotiating table. And he actually threatened to withhold money, the aid, the life-saving mechanism for Israel. And he actually did withhold money. But they knew that if they are a bit patient, they could actually overcome that particular moment. My fear is that this is the plan right now. And I'm less optimistic about the settlement issue, freezing the settlement, than maybe freezing is 6 months. What 6 months? This is an illegal activity. You don't freeze it 6 months. Or it has to be frozen long ago. And not only freezing illegal activities, it has to be demolished altogether. Something that was built on stolen land, on stolen farms and homes, has to be demolished. But this is a start. Let's wait another 6 months, and maybe I'll be more optimistic or less optimistic.
Hello. I just want to give one of my best friends and my flatmate a voice. Her name's Ines, and she actually knows your family. And she spent the last year studying with me in London. We're both Palestinians. She's from Gaza, and I'm from Jerusalem. And right now, she's stuck in Gaza. The school year is going to begin in about 2 or 3 weeks, and she can't get out. She went home because her family suffered a lot during the war. She was in London, and they were in Gaza. The house was bombed by about 14 rockets. And she couldn't stand the thought of the time passing without seeing her family and making sure they're okay, despite the fact that there was not a home to go back to. She managed to get in through Rafah, and now she's stuck. Whatever your political views are, whatever you think about various militant factions or non-militant factions, what's happening to Ines is wrong. She deserves to go to university just the same as I do and just the same as you do. And we have to stand up, because if we don't stand up and say stop and let her out and let her come back to study, then nobody will. And if we don't push the British Embassy and the British Consulate to do something, then they won't, because they've already told her no. They've already said, we have other things to worry about, we can't help you. And she's just one person out of many people in that situation. And just remember, she's just a normal student, 22 years old, who's never been in any kind of militant action at all. All she wants to do is come and continue her education, and she can't get out. So I'm saying to all of you, if any of you have any way of putting pressure on or just raising awareness, then please do, because it's a very real issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I add my voice to yours, and by picking on one particular person, case, it's not you are forgetting about others, but you are also bringing others who are suffering like her to the fore. So if you can help this lady and this student to come back, that will be a good start. And there are many experiences of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and many other groups who have been successful in bringing Palestinian students and perhaps putting some pressure.
Hi. You say quite rightly that Israel has been built on land stolen from the Palestinians. When Arafat agreed or proposed the 22% acceptance position, would it have made any difference at all to either the Palestinians in the refugee camps or to the Israelis, if there had been some sort of compensation for the land that had been stolen from them?
That's a very good question. A very good question. Of course, it would have been much better. But the Palestinian collective brain, if you may, has really decided to, and I quote here a very good friend of mine and who was a Palestinian ambassador to the UK, Afif Safi, who used to say that the Palestinians have been unreasonably reasonable in their offer. At that particular moment, the Palestinian calculation was that what we need is to stand again on our feet, establish our state. We have the confidence to build a thriving society again. We want to heal our wounds. We want to connect again with our communities. And we want to establish any Palestinian state at any piece of land of Palestine. And they knew that the international mood, the intervention and interference, the corporate world and the money and the lobbyists, lobby groups, they knew that the region and the dynamics were not all favorable to their side. And this was rather the very compromising school of thought, the very pragmatic school of thought that has won the hearts and minds of the vast majority of Palestinians. Because in the end, they wanted to proceed. 100% justice is always desirable. But was it achievable at the time? It wasn't. But even that is no longer available. That is without the compensation. 78% of what was rightly ours, without receiving any compensation. Even the 22% is no longer available. And I think the two-state solution is to be safe even under a huge strain. And I'm not so sure if it is any longer available. I was in the West Bank a few months ago and I drove around. It's a Swiss cheese. It's almost a disconnected enclaves, and it's like a mushroom in cancer going by the day. You've got to think of the situation in terms of pain and pleasure. This is politics. And allow me for 1 minute to say that in politics, you have to either really inflict some pain on your opponent and at the same time make sure that he or she are aware of, sorry for this expression, but meaning in politics, pleasure, as in what could be the rewards in the future. The Palestinians so far have been, even if they use the pain part, have been denied any legitimacy of it. And because of the intervention and interference and the international system, they are not able to offer the rewards. And therefore, for Israel, so long as we keep talking about peace processes, negotiations, it's a very profitable occupation. Only the last 5 years, they have invested $5 billion in the Jordan Valley of the West Bank, growing the majul, which is the dates, the big dates. Only majul, $5 billion, and brings a lot of money. If we keep just trying to find a political settlement via negotiations and trying to always follow the formula that we have to provide security for our occupier, which has been happening for the last 16 years, and therefore reducing the cost of occupation, then this formula will not get us anywhere. And the problem is, you need to find international partners. And you need to find legitimate ways to raise the cost of occupation. I cannot think of any other formula. The cost has to be risen to a level whereby they have to leave. They are very comfortable. And you know what? Throughout the history of mankind, those who are privileged will not give away their privileges voluntarily. They don't, not in South Africa, not in anywhere else. They have to be forced to leave their privileges. The Israeli per capita income, the Israeli per capita income is $24,000. You know how much is the Palestinian per capita income? $1,400. How many times the Israeli per capita income is higher? Go to Tel Aviv and see the villas and the swimming pools. Why would a person who partly live on the benefit of occupation would give up that? Why he or she would give up their swimming pool? Let the people of Gaza die. You know, the American congressman, the very famous congressman, John Kerry, who was a presidential candidate, went to Gaza as he was exiting a few months ago, just after the war, to investigate. As he was leaving Gaza, he saw a pile of trucks waiting at the borders, and then the Israeli soldiers turning the trucks back. And he asked, what's happening? His colleagues told him, oh, this is a trucks of macaroni, of, you know, pasta. And according to Israeli list of goods, pasta is not an essential item. and therefore it cannot get into Gaza. And the man went absolutely crazy. This is insane. So he went on, and there was almost a public row with Israel. And finally, that particular shipment of macaroni went into Gaza after the intervention of an official letter from Clinton, Hillary Clinton. This will tell you about the mentality. The mentality of wanting to both quoting an Israeli official, the prime minister's advisor, of wanting to put an entire nation on diet. That's what he said. Of a government that would meet in 2003 under the leadership of Sharon and would come out with a public Israeli government statement saying that we are going to kill Yasser Arafat. Have you ever heard of a government that would come out and say we are killing the leader of another nation? Only Israel, because Israel has been fed all these years that it is above the law. It is above international law. It is above human law. It is even above the divine law.
Last question.
There's one more question, and then Linda wants to make some announcements.
Hassam, I just wanted to pick up on your answer to the previous question when you mentioned about the regimes of the surrounding countries having exploited the Palestinian issue for their own self-interest. And of course, you're right. One thing I would like to say, though, to people here, I mean, having traveled throughout and across the Arab world over a lot of years, no one should doubt, I don't think, that the majority of people in that area, in the surrounding countries, stand fully four square with the Palestinians and recognize their sense of injustice, whether they're Jordanian, Syrian, Iranian. You know, they all share that sense of injustice. And I'm quite sure the majority of the people in Egypt are outraged at their government's maintenance of the embargo on Israel's orders at Rafah. That's appalling.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what happened during the war, the demonstrations and the anger in the Arab world, I hope I did mention when I said that it was the regimes who depended partly on their relationship and on their existence, on external support. But the Arab world has been boiling for all these years. And every single politician, whether from the Arab world or elsewhere, every analyst would go all the way to say that the Palestine issue is the core of the Middle East, is the core of international peace and security, is the crux of instability worldwide. And I would agree with that assessment. Why? Because it touches upon the very basic human, even soul. It touches upon everything. It angers people beyond comprehension when they see all these children in Gaza or elsewhere. And it is almost, in the past, it was the source of unity. It was the source of messages worldwide, of spiritual connection. Now it's a source of division. So I just want to give a closing statement by saying the following. Despite all these hits, you know, from dispossession in 1948, an entire country has come and replaced your own society. Then military occupation, vicious policies, closures, murders, arrests. We have more than 11,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, most of whom are not even sentenced. Despite all the above, the society remains solid. Solid not only in terms of being able to produce democracy. Even in the last few weeks, you may have been following the Fatah Convention and the election process. They're still doing their bits to try and bring new leaderships, new representation, with the ills and the goods and the bads, but they are doing it. And despite all this, the Palestine ambassador to the UK now is an Armenian Palestinian, Christian. He immigrated with his father, immigrated to Palestine only 100 years ago, where the very tolerant Palestinian society embraced them not only as equal parties, as equal citizens, as equal brothers and sisters, but as Palestine's ambassadors. Because that society knows no borders, knows no limits, knows no divisions. That society does not approve of excluding others on any basis. And believe you me, it is solid enough to carry its wound and proceed. I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt that one day they will position themselves again right in the center of humanity. And they will yet again be a hub, a center, a core, a pillar for the advancement of the international and the human family at large. But the question is that how do you help this society keep its roots, keep its tolerance, keep its diversity? How do you help them face this rather the most exclusive ideology on the face of earth? How do you help them to try and not to fall into the trap that has been meant to them all these years? And I think helping them is definitely by insisting and ensuring that their tolerance, their behavior is upheld, is kept, continues by your support, and that their aggressor, that the racism of their aggressor has to be confronted. It is a duty now that we confront it. No longer we continue talking about peace. Peace is a nice word. Peace is a word of God. We all seek peace. But if peace means quiet, then this is not the peace that we meant. Peace means dignity. Peace means equality. Peace means that you are able to wake up in the morning with some sort of hope for the future and for next week and the week after. It does not mean negative peace, that there is no shooting anywhere or there is no violence. Because if we have negative peace that is quiet, few months down the line, it will break down as happened all along. And for that to happen, there is one thing that needs to be confronted. One thing. Racism has to end. Racism has to end. And I know it will end. And inshallah, hopefully, I'll see you in Jerusalem in less than a year. Thank you very much.
This is not your only opportunity to hear Hussam. He's speaking this afternoon. He's part of a panel that we're bringing together at 4:15 in Hebron. Please come along. We've got programs. If you haven't picked one up yet, come to the Rediscovering Palestine stall. We've got Jeff Helper speaking at 3 o'clock, followed by this panel of which Hussam is a part. And we'll be talking again about our vision for the future and how you can all be helping us achieve that day of freedom for the Palestinians. Thank you for coming. Thank you again, Hussam.